And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Hello, Dean Haglund.
Hello, Phil Lairness from Down Under. No, I'm from Down Under. Hello from Down Under, Phil Lairness.
Take 12. Dean Down Haglunder.
See how funny that is? Not anymore.
Well, come on. It took 2 weeks before any of us could say it without stepping all over it.
I know. And now everybody went, yeah. I guess it's all right.
Dean Down Haglunder as doesn't trip off your tongue at all.
Dean Down Haglunder.
Of course, the rule, of course, at your Chilpack Hollywood Hour is if something's funny, keep saying it until it's not funny.
That's how we operate.
And then keep saying it again until it's funny again.
Right. Which takes a year or two. Don't kid yourself.
We have nothing but time.
Right. And listen, it's worth the journey. Like, what else are you going to do?
Well, it is. It's not about the end result of the laughter. The payoff to process is process.
Absolutely. So you go through it, and then one day you realize you're laughing for no reason. And it's either the joke is funny again, or you have dementia.
Oh, my goodness. I have been getting so many advertisements. Or advertisements, I guess, maybe, down under.
Advertisements, yeah, now we can pronounce that. And harassment.
Why'd you bring that up?
I don't know. Those are the two words that I now say, advertisement and harassment.
Anyway, I've been getting a lot of advertisements about cremation from Forest Lawn Mortuary.
Oh, yeah.
So they,
to tell you something?
Yeah, they may know something I don't.
We looked at your records, and you might want to consider cremation.
Yeah.
Is that what? That's weird.
I want to be cremated, and I want my ashes spread throughout the pool at the Eastern Columbia Building.
Well, I doubt you get that part done, but, you know, now they say cremation, with all the fillings in your mouth, adds to the mercury poisoning of the air.
So are they talking really specifically about me?
They are. They know your fillings. And so now the thing is you get liquefied in a vat that ultrasonic water just turns everything into a liquid mass. And then your fillings just sit at the bottom and they collect them and dispose of them in an environmentally safe way.
In an environmental safe way. Because so it's sponsored to you by, okay, that's a joke that only people in a certain part of the country would know.
That's right.
You know, we have a whole show to get to, but this is so fascinating. And for some reason, reminds me of two things. One, that I think I'm going to finally buckle down and join the Los Angeles Breakfast Club.
Ah, good for you. I thought you were a member.
No, I've just been arm candy up till now.
Wow.
And so I'm going to join. But this last week at the LA Breakfast Club, and I guess I should play a live event of the week and all that sort of stuff, but it wasn't even on the agenda today. I just, I thought you would find it interesting. It, of course, made me miss you. We had the president of the, is it the LA Historic Theater Foundation, come and speak to us. So, you know, about all the restorations of the great remaining picture palaces of downtown.
Right. Was that, I forget the guy's name.
S. Scott something. S. Scott.
Yeah, yeah. Escott
Norton. Escott Norton, my staff. Norton.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My crack staff of elves. Just let me know.
Yes, I've emailed him a couple of times as a volunteer for that organization.
On, fat lot there's... of volunteering you can do from down under. Give till it hurts. That's your motto.
I'll be there. I'll be there one day, I say.
So why don't we begin with a little letter we received that starts, "Hi, Phil and Dean." And when I say,
"Oh, hello,"
when I say begin, look, this last 5 minutes hasn't been filler. This has been darn good free podcasting entertainment.
Right. We got to remind that every 5 minutes for some reason. I don't know why.
"Hi, Phil and Dean.
Hello.
Am just listening to this week's episode."
Excellent.
Parenthetical comment follows. "At least it's before the next one is out!" Exclamation mark.
Fantastic.
"And thought I'd drop you guys a line!" Exclamation mark.
Well, there's lots of exclamation marks.
The term, quote, "sensei," which Dean pointed out was used in martial arts, has a far broader use in Japanese, which I think you knew. I think you were just using martial arts as an exemplar.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't want to get into the whole semantics of Japanese.
Well, you're anti-semantic.
See what you did?
The term is used to address teachers and professors at all levels in all disciplines, as well as physicians, dentists, and other medical professionals. When I was a teaching assistant for the elementary modern Japanese course at UCLA is, I guess, how it's pronounced.
Sure.
That would be the University of California, Los Angeles, of course. I was, quote, "Nagumo sensei." By the way, the reverb on Dean's end is actually kind of cool.
Damn it.
You'll have to listen to last week's show then to enjoy that. This podcast is obviously a great labor of love, seeing the effort you both are making to get it out week after week, despite the great distance between you. Thank goodness for technology. With warm regards, Takako. And of course, Takako is our friend at the United Nations. Now, that reverb is something that I wanted to address because it really did sound cool, and I'm glad that she appreciates the effort we put into this because it actually took no small amount of time to get it to sound that acceptable.
Yes, as opposed to the echo.
Yeah, we really... had to work on it to bring it down just to that very cool, authoritative, Darth Vader-esque reverb. And if, we were probably pretty close to not recording, I would think. It had taken so long. But then again, I was just piss-ass drunk, so what do I know?
Well, and if you have to picture me in my studio in Australia... with my lips inches away from the keyboard.
This is getting really creepy. This is sounding like X-Files Lone Gunman fan fiction.
See what you did.
He pressed
anyway,
his lips
I'm
close to the what?
The
he what? Pressed his lips to whose keyboard?
No, that's where the microphone... Anyway, I had to really talk close to the mic, I guess, is what I was trying to say.
You did. And we're glad. We appreciate the give till it hurts effort, Dean Hackland. We got a series of tweets from, I don't know if it's Marlena?
Okay.
Marlena sounds so... exotic and exciting.
Exotic.
So
yeah, let's say
Marlena. Yeah. Listen to number 433. That would be your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, 433. Discussion of Oliver Sacks, Robin Williams, the importance of releasing a character, and the real symbology of cancer. It was very affecting. I'm adding full words and sentences to this.
Yeah, how did
this
you get that in 150
series,
characters?
That's a series of tweets. It was a series of tweets.
Okay.
The scientist in me is skeptical of assigning meetings. Oh, I better start drinking. The scientist in me is skeptical of assigning meanings to types of cancer, but I believe in that larger possibility. Also wonder if Dr. Sack's relatively recent public disclosure of his sexuality played a part in physical disease ambivalence. Now, see, I didn't realize that.
I did not realize this
and
either.
Of course, that would be another thing, since, again, as we were saying, it was liver cancer, and about it, you know, being something unexpressed and something unreleased. Well, that indeed would fit in with this theory altogether.
Right.
She continues, "I don't like to pathologize lives, though." She finishes with, "Relatedly, I think Robin Williams let his portrayals help him as much as his own trials found their way into his work. Sorry for the long tweet." And I wanted to share this because, of course, we were not trying to pathologize anyone's life, let alone Dr. Sachs, who had contributed so much. However, one can also use these incidents as cautionary tales, as inspirational tales, and reminding us that certainly if this theory of approaching dis-ease as ramifications of, or representations of how we live our life and what we fail to express and embody, you know, and knowing that the truth of that for myself, then it's important to talk about these things, because certainly we want to advocate for everyone in Chilpack Nation to, you know, live and speak your truth. No matter how much it might frighten you, it is ultimately healthy if you can embody the truth of who you really are.
Right, because you're put at ease, and there is no, as you said, dis-ease.
Thank you. It just kind of became a little bit of a Sesame Street.
Right. A moment of dis-ease. Disease.
What letter is producing today? The Today Show is brought to you by...
what do we got so far? There's a lot of D. D, Dean Down Under. D,
well, I think D, for many weeks, it's just been the letter X of this for this summer. The letter X has been bringing us... I enjoy what I did there. And indeed, you know, Robin Williams, absolutely, you know, he let life in, and that and that's what made his performances so resonant when they were resonant. And, you know, I saw the great film. I imagine you're a big fan of this, Preston Sturges comedy. I know my mentor at my old days at UCLA, Alexander Payne, was a huge fan of this comedy. Sullivan's Travels. I saw this again. Are you a fan?
I love that. Okay. I am a fan.
And you know what was interesting for me? I hadn't seen it since film school. And for watching the actors, of course, I am a big fan of Joel McRae and have seen so many films over the last few years of his. But I never really cared about Veronica Lake before.
Really?
And, yeah, because, you know, even by Blue Dahlia, which was a big comeback for her in the late 40s, when she was all of 25 years old, there was already a degree to which she was used up by Hollywood. And but who she was in Sullivan's Travels was so spunky and had so much... I mean, she was only 19 when they filmed that thing, but she had so much depth and so much spunk and so much range... And so I was so impressed that I felt the need to have some research given to me about her. And she had been diagnosed as a teenager with schizophrenia. And acting was prescribed to her, much like acting was prescribed to our friend Tucker Smallwood to combat his PTSD. You know, and it was very therapeutic for her. And you can see kind of through her career... when bouts of mental illness would return, there really was a correlation between how many and the quality of roles she got and how much she maintained her mental health versus when her box office wasn't quite there. So the roles started to dry up and the roles were really kind of demeaning. Her mental health problems would return because she wasn't, and again, I'm pathologizing, but I think there's a very important cautionary note in all of this, which is when she wasn't able to let this in and process it and work it out and express it through these characters, she wasn't nearly as healthy.
Huh. Interesting. And that's at the time too, when you were contracted to a studio. So they would often pigeonhole you and see you as such and not really take into consideration that you were doing this for your mental health and not just to be star, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the therapist that suggested that she take up acting for her mental health, you know, didn't say get on a bus, move to Beverly Hills, change your name, become a sex symbol for your mental health. He may have meant community theater.
Yeah, that could have been just as effective, but somehow.
But it was her parents that it suddenly dawned on her mother and her stepfather what they had on their hands. So they sold off everything and moved to Beverly Hills to get little.
Did they really?
To get their girl, who I think whose name was Constance, get her into the movies. But, you know, seriously, again, by 19, think about this. At 19 years of age, not only is she playing the lead in what would become really, you know, one of the handful of greatest films of all time, one of the most important comedies of all time, Sullivan's Travels. But also, while she's making it, she's 6 months pregnant and she's been married for almost 2 years. So this is the sort of woman who by 19 really reminds you how little you've accomplished with your life.
Oh, I'm reminded about that every day. But, you know, it's interesting too that how we remember her now is just as a blonde bombshell with the Veronica Lake haircut over one eye, you know, demure and ingenue. And it's interesting that when you actually look at her performances, that depth that's there that we don't remember like we do, say, I don't know, Ida Lupino or something like that, you know. And it's weird how history remembers the great talents of the of previous generations.
Well, her star burnt so bright, but for such a short period of time, really. I mean, she doesn't have a big catalog of classic films. You know, she was at the top of the profession for a few years, and then it passed her by. Here we are talking about Veronica Lake, someone who died in, I think it was 73, at only age 51. But we have another one of my, not favorite, but really from when I was a kid, one of my favorite actors from back then to remember in a little segment we call Celebrity Deaths.
Celebrity Deaths.
That's what I said, Garrett Watley. Martin Sam Milner, who died on September 6th, 2015, right after we concluded last week's recording, was an American film, stage, radio, and television actor, best known for his performances in two popular television series. I would even say that one of these is seminal, but I'd have to look up what that means.
Right.
Route 66, which aired on CBS from 1960 to 1964, in which co-starred George Maharis, one of my favorite names to say, George Maharis. That's why I bring it up, George Maharis. And Adam 12, which when I was a kid was still on first run. It debuted the year I was born, 1968, ran to 1975. I believe my first lunch pail I ever brought to school was
Adam 12.
And Adam 12. I collected Adam 12 comic books, even. It was Martin Milner and, of course, Kent McCord, who we've talked about a little bit on this show and how dedicated he still is to working out.
and the Screen Actors Guild.
Well, yeah, okay. But that's always how we always see him in, like, walking into gyms, handing out flyers for whatever office he's running for. But that's Kent McCord. That's not the great Marty Milner. And and Marty Milner, long before being a television lead, and, you know, he comes from this sort of era. He started as a contract player, studio contract player in the 50s, and he had that kind of earnest, steady, everyman quality that I bet in the day, in the 1950s, made people say, oh, he's got a young Glenn Ford quality.
Absolutely. Yeah, you could see that. And that quality now isn't really called upon or ever written. You never see that in the any of the TV shows anymore, the kind of steadfast, steady, right on tone of delivery.
Well, I don't even know if you see it. I don't even know if you see it in movies much anymore. I think, I think that that's a great appeal of Kevin Costner over the decades has been that he's embodied that while at the same time embodying some kind of modern sort of sense of humor and sensibility. I think he's embodied. Look, Kevin, when they get who, when they get somebody to replace Glenn Ford, to, you know, or to play the role Glenn Ford played in the first Superman in Man of Steel, who do they get? They get Kevin Costner. And I think I think older generations responded and helped Kevin Costner achieve and maintain stardom because he had that. But there aren't a lot of roles for it. And and after Adam 12, you know, not a lot for Martin Milner in terms of significant work afterwards. And I think it's because you come out of a post-Watergate era where the it maybe a whole part of the culture feels like the men of that era failed us.
Right. That was the establishment that the counter-revolution was rallying against.
It's so funny, isn't it, that in one of my favorite films, Sweet Smell of Success, where he plays opposite Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, one of his first early major roles, he plays with the exact same Martin Milner haircut and wardrobe. He plays the crazy jazz musician who wants to marry Burt Lancaster's sister. And, well, I don't know if you should marry someone who's a jazz musician who's probably, you know, smoking the reefer. And it's Marty Milner.
Wow. That's casted against type, I guess.
But he does ultimately bring this, what's revealed, just this really earnest, honest, heartfelt, hardworking, I will never laugh unless you really, really demand it of me kind of American sensibility.
And a calmness. There's a calmness throughout all of his performances. Like when you look at Adam 12 now, as I watch it on TV Land occasionally, it is the portrayal of LAPD as the calming influence in a crazy domestic situation or a bank robbery. It's just these two calm guys, which is not the picture that we have now of, you know, police in general.
Yeah, that whole Rodney King video that went viral, and if any of you remember that, would have played out a little differently if the responding officers had been Martin Milner and Kent McCord.
Absolutely. They would have just talked to him politely, a wry smile, and be on your way, sir.
But how about that Route 66?
Yeah.
You know, that was a really, really... First of all, it was a really cool show, but I also do believe that it was it both captured a spirit of America at the time. You know, really, we're taken out to the open road and we're exploring. It also paved the way, right, for anthology series of the time.
Traveling anthology series, going from town to town. Sort of like, you know, Kung Fu or whatever, Have Gun, Will Travel. All of those things where stories happen in different parts of the town. And correct me if I'm wrong, weren't they driving a red 62 Corvette in that? That was a classic.
It was some kind of classic, though I think they may have had two cars. I'm not quite sure. Because, of course, it started black and white. Was it always? It may have always been in black and white, so I don't know if we ever knew the color for sure.
Right.
But it was a classic car. But, you know, how about the influence it had to have been on The Fugitive? You talk about the traveling anthology show. People forget, I think, in the wake of the Harrison Ford movie, the fact that the Fugitive TV series was every bit an anthology, you know, the modern equivalent, well, not modern anymore, but would have been The Incredible Hulk, right? Where the main character's on the run, but the story each week is about the characters that they meet in the new town.
Yeah,
and
the relationships that develop and how he solves some little... you know, issue in that town and then moves on.
And in the case of The Fugitive, it really was quite astonishingly emotional. But in Route 66, they got into some really interesting stuff. And especially here you are at the beginning of the 60s, some looks at how, you know, America across its face was changing.
Right. Yeah. At that great transition, just as, you know, you think about how fast the culture changed. Just hearing about the Beach Boys, for instance, number one album, 1963, 64. And by 68, they could not get arrested. Their albums weren't even selling 100,000. So to be from a number one rock band to having trouble selling just a couple of your albums in a period of 3 years suggests that that's how fast the culture changed in the 60s.
Yeah.
Amazing.
There is there's a little bit of movie news that I wanted to get your take on.
And
that was Danny Boyle has announced that his next project is going to be a Trainspotting sequel.
I heard that with the original cast coming together.
And I've got to tell you, my feelings of this were to take me right back to when I was in film school and when Bogdanovich revisited Last Picture Show with his sequel Texasville and Nicholson stepping in for Polanski, who could not come back into the country. Nevertheless, rejoined with his Chinatown collaborators, screenwriter Robert Towne and producer Robert Evans, to do The Two Jakes. And,
Which you liked, I did.
I think both of these films have some things going for it. If I'm not mistaken, Texasville even might have gotten an Oscar nomination or two. But, you know, that, and then years later, you would have, like, James L. Brooks revisiting Terms of Endearment.
Yeah.
There's just, maybe even we should throw in Coppola doing Godfather 3. There's something about filmmakers going back and doing a sequel 15, 20 years later that, I don't know, I would caution against.
You would? Wait, you just gave examples of everything you loved.
No, I didn't love them. And I would actually think that maybe, you know, Two Jakes, for me, works the best of any of those because it was a different director. You know, and you're a different person 20 years on. And we've talked about the challenge sometimes actors have, right? Revisiting roles.
How does it resonate?
Many years later.
Changed?
How much have you changed? How much has the character changed? Because you're not going back to find the character that a young version of you once played. You've got to find this whole new character that's many years on in life. So there is a real challenge to it. It's not just like putting on the wardrobe. And I think the same is true of directors. Just because you were the right person for it then might not make you the right person for it now, even if you've written it. And, you know, anyway, I don't know if I want to get into more of that, but I am hard pressed to think of one where it really worked. George Lucas, you know, revisited those Star Wars movies 20 years later.
Oh, yes. Well, that's a prime example. But think about Trainspotting, though. I mean,
how about Spielberg in the fourth Indiana Jones movie? Was that the same director who did the first few? I don't.
Jeez, you are tearing this asunder, aren't you? Well, fears aside, let's just look at Trainspotting itself, though. It's a story of a group of characters awash in drugs and that sort of thing. And I would think.
Oh, sure. Spoil it for Yoshi.
What? Who doesn't know?
I know. I always get like a spoiler complaint from him about stuff.
Jeez. Okay. Anyway, the point is that I would think now there would be rehab. Like, how have the lives of these characters moved on? And is there going to be a 20-year gap? And are they reuniting, going on another drug-fueled adventure? Or are they actually gone through rehab and, you know, all that sort of thing? I could see that being as interesting as the original.
Yeah, I'm not saying that revisiting the characters can't work in many mediums. Hey, did you hear about Harper Lee's prequel to
Kill a Mockingbird?
To Kill a Mockingbird?
Yeah.
Is it Go Set the Watchman, I think is the name of it? And
right.
This sounds great. I can't wait to read this because, you know, I love the book To Kill a Mockingbird as much as the next person, unless the next person loves it, and have never been able to stand that stinking movie.
Really?
I know it makes me un-American, but boy, there's something about Gregory Peck that is always just an actor in a costume walking around on a set. But but this book I can't wait for because, of course, you know, it's the book she originally wrote. And the publisher said, well, we can't publish this right away. This is way too incendiary. So why don't you do this to pave the way for this book? Because we intend to publish it. But why don't you do this? Could you go back in and write a full book about the incident that the woman is remembering from her childhood where her dad represented this man in this court case? And so that's how To Kill a Mockingbird was born. It was actually basically the prequel. You know, I mean, yeah, it's a prequel.
Yeah.
Right. This is a sequel. Yeah. But this is a sequel that was written first. And so the book that she wrote in To Kill a Mockingbird was to show how unreliable childhood testimony is. Because this girl thought of her dad as a hero. Whereas in the book she originally wrote, that is now finally released, Atticus is very much the villain. In fact,
and,
he's a Klansman.
Yeah, a racist.
Yeah.
Klansman.
So I love that we're finally going to revisit with some depth and some complexity this character of Atticus Finch. And I believe that Harper Lee never, you know, publishing this book and really staying away from the literary world as much as she could, just smacks to me of someone who is so uncomfortable with the success and with the embrace that book got.
That now this is the book that she always intended to have published.
Yeah. Now it's fine. Now it's fine.
Now I'm good. Let me know when you read that.
Maybe we'll get back to what we're reading and we'll and we'll discuss that. Any chance that down under there you were able to catch the first week of Stephen Colbert on The Late Show?
There's not a chance because it is somehow not within my cable box. But I had been able to see a couple clips of it on YouTube, but where the screen is very small and somewhat truncated.
You need to see the full 20-minute interview with Joe Biden. Not only is it the best interview of Stephen Colbert's fantastic career, but it's the best interview that's been on late-night television in many years.
Is that right?
Yes. And what was astonishing was if you take these four nights as one whole introduction, the only way to sum up, because as you know, those first shows, the emphasis on them is way too great, right?
Yeah.
Yes, you've had a lot of time to prep stuff and everything, but as a performer, right? You don't come out of the gate when you've been building up that long really with your best stuff because you haven't settled into it yet. You haven't found the energy. You know, there's a little bit of working it out that has to go on. And indeed, they had huge technical problems, for example, that they had to edit throughout. And they didn't even know if that first night was going to air until just a couple moments before it was supposed to go on. So, you know, there was a lot in flux. But if you take the four nights in total, the only response you can have from seeing all of it and seeing what stands out as working so well is what a Salon reviewer wrote, which was specifically Stephen Colbert has this thing in the bag.
Wow.
I mean, it is just a question of how long will, you know, the network allow him and how much will they allow him to do his show. If they do, this is what we thought we probably weren't going to get anymore, which was an adult in late night television who can change the tenor of the conversation and who can revitalize the form.
Well, now, but correct me if I'm wrong. He is not that different than his character.
He's entirely different from his character. Entirely different. He's let the character go. As he said in one interview, for many years, he played a narcissistic conservative pundit, whereas now he's simply a narcissist.
Oh, okay.
No, now the humanity, he gets into a several minute long conversation with the Vice President of the United States about how much their faith matters to them. And it's riveting and it's moving and it's beautiful. Jon Stewart said it best. He said, you know, Stephen was not, yes, he was hosting a show, and yes, he was doing interviews, but he really was an actor. on the Colbert Report playing a character. Mm. And the problem that most actors have when they turn then to late night hosting or any kind of, hosting gig, the problem that they have, and right now I'm looking at you, James Corden, or I'm not, because like the rest of America, I can't stand watching you. but how about Chevy Chase, you know, who would have seemed to have had a lot of skills, but boy, when he was Chevy Chase, he had nothing to offer. And what Jon Stewart said the challenge was, is that you have to, in removing the character, reveal what you've been hiding while you've been playing that character. And he said in a pre-interview, he said, or after the opening night performance, rather, he said what people didn't realize, except those who've worked with him, is that what Stevens kept hidden is he has the deepest, most humble humanity of anyone in this business.
Wow.
And so it's a show that is both wickedly funny while incredibly humane. And it's something that I never thought that I was going to get again, which was no matter how crazy or disturbing or just awful and vile and brain damaging the political conversation might be in a given day, in a few minutes, he's able to make me feel okay about the whole thing.
Oh, well, now that's optimistic.
I literally have slept better because of his first shows. I'm not joking.
That is phenomenal. That right there is your call out, I think, for your review. I literally slept better. Because, you know, you're right. There's not been a lot of humanity in the tenor, but also in late night television. You think about how the irony of Letterman when he first came on in the 80s and this mocking, detached thing that all the other talk shows picked up.
Yeah,
that sort of dehumanized not only the talk show, but the whole, you know, went away from the Dick Cavett days and the Merv Griffin days where it was like a deeply, hey, wow, that's really cool conversation, to this kind of ironic, oh, we're just doing bits and jokes and stuff like that, that sort of commodified
the manners,
entire...
The manners of a Johnny Carson who was confident enough in his own comedic sensibility and timing to want you to excel as a guest. Mm-hmm. That
Absolutely.
Seems to have gotten lost. And like you say, the humanity, the deep humanity that so many of these other guests in other time slots would reveal. You're right. The closest that anybody comes in this modern age is that passes for humanity is Jimmy Fallon sucking up to guests.
Right. And that's sort of cutish, adorable in a gerbil kind of way, but that's about it.
So in terms of viral videos from the week, obviously check out the full interview with Biden. That is not a viral video. It's 20 minutes long, I think, the full unedited video. But you will also enjoy the coffee commercial with Laura Linney. Colbert, coffee commercial, Laura Linney. I guarantee you that's the first big viral hit thus far for Colbert. And two other little things that I really love. When with Scarlett Johansson, it's Stephen Colbert asks, I think, big questions of the big stars or big questions for even bigger stars. That's really fun. And Stephen's unseen mysteries of the unexplained. It's going to be a regular paranormal segment, and he does it on the South Carolina Lizard Man, and it's quite good.
Wow. Now there's one degree of separation from me to the Colbert show. For those who remember the Lone Gunman spinoff, there was another character not played by Stephen Sneddon, who played Jimmy Bond, but there was a Jimmy the Geek. I guess he was like a computer guy that was nerdier and cooler than the Lone Gunman, who came in, you know, I think he did about 3 or 4 episodes over the time.
Right.
Played by an actor by the name of Jim Fife, who is now segment producer on the new Stephen Colbert show. So I think that sounds like one of his bits. And I need to look at the IMDb to figure that out.
There's a 1 degree of separation in this household, too, when Stephen Colbert apologized to his choir teacher that he had back when he was in high school, who happened to be Lily Holloman's choir teacher as well. So that's quite exciting. So we got to move on here, but you brought up The Lone Gunman. So, you know, I saw that the X-Files... not the pilot, but episode 1 of season 10 is going to have its premiere very soon in New York at the IGN Comic-Con there in New York.
Yes. Isn't that something? This is the testament to everyone saying what I'm hearing is that the new reboot is exceeding everyone's expectations.
I didn't like Jillian's comments that it's like comfort food. It'll really give people what they want, and she's been asking, don't we need to give them more? But apparently this is what they want. That didn't sound so good to me.
No.
Because I feel like giving people what they wanted might have gotten them in trouble in the past. But but you know what? I'm wondering if I'm sure we have listeners who are going to be at that event and who are going to catch it. We should duly deputize some listeners to maybe do a review, an exclusive review on Chill Pack Hollywood
Hour. What a
great
idea.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
So anyone wants to volunteer for that gig, please let us know forthwith. You can stop listening right now and send us an email. Dean, there is a show that I love that comes from your part of the world, and that's Top of the Lake.
Top of the Lake?
Yeah.
This I have not seen.
It was the Jane Campion series that starred Elizabeth Moss and Holly Hunter. I really, really enjoyed this show. I binged watched it last year, and season 2 is coming. And at first, there was a report that Nicole Kidman was joining the cast, and now apparently that's not happening for whatever reason. But let's pretend it was, so that I can get out my soapbox for a minute and get upset about this.
Let's dust off the soapbox.
Because I saw Nicole Kidman recently in Hello Ladies, the movie, the feature-length wrap-up to the HBO series Hello Ladies. And Nicole Kidman plays herself. And what I kept muttering over and over and over and over again was, oh, dear God, her face. Oh, dear God, her face. You know, this woman has been no stranger to plastic surgery at all. I mean, it doesn't even look like there's factory parts remaining.
Is this in the realm of Laura Flynn Boyle, or is it...
It's just really, you know, for a long time she hadn't been able to move her forehead. She hadn't been able to emote or express with her face.
Right.
And you really didn't want her to laugh or smile because you were scared things were going to pop off. And if the film was 3D, they might hit you. This just sounds all sorts of mean to Nicole Kidman. Look, whatever makes her feel better about herself, fine. Okay.
Right.
But what bothers me is, Nicole Kidman is an actress of great talent. And now I look at her and it's, what roles is she going to play? What roles is she going to be called upon to play? Really, in anything good, there's only two types of roles she could play. One is that very particular type of trophy wife, right?
Yeah.
And the other is a Nicole Kidman impersonator. She could get cast. She still looks somewhat like Nicole Kidman enough to play a Nicole Kidman impersonator. So, you know, this is the thing. I am actually going to put my foot down, stick my foot in the sand on this, and I'm going to say, you know what? I'm never going to cast people who've had the obvious plastic surgery. I'm not going to do it. And one of the reasons I'm not going to do it is because, you know, Nicole Kidman is going to keep getting work, and she's going to keep getting work because her name is Nicole Kidman.
And she lives in a fear of...
But she's going to get cast. Exactly. So she's going to keep getting it because she lives in a fear of getting old. She lives in a fear of not getting roles. Meanwhile, she's going to keep getting roles because she's Nicole Kidman. But she's going to stop getting roles when Nicole Kidman being in something is a hindrance to the success of that, or is seen as a hindrance to the success of it. But as long as she's going to keep getting work, what's the message that people are sending? Obviously, the reason she's getting cast might have to do with her talent, but more often it has to do with her name and what kind of box office clout she has or what kind of visibility she has or how many positive right. mentions on social media she's going to be able to get us. But when you cast someone like that, you're sending the message that this is what we're looking for. We're looking for people who can't use their faces, who don't look human anymore. So young girls out there, you know, even young men out there, watch her when you get to a certain age, start cutting yourself. And I'm not going to participate in that game anymore. There is nothing more beautiful than the human face, especially when the human face is authentic and expresses the humanity of the person inside. And Nicole Kidman's face does not express the humanity. It simply is a mask that both hides and screams out loud the fear of the person who's wearing it.
Well, and I think you've hit upon a point of the beauty of authenticity that, again, humanity in a talk show has been reinvented. I don't know. Now I'm on a soapbox. Is it all of our mediation, our iPads and social media, everything that our reality has now experienced through devices as opposed to just experiencing reality by walking out the front door, we have lost the ability to discern what an authentic experience actually is. Therefore, we don't value anybody being authentic. We value that which is altered for mediums, plural, consumption. Did that?
It's almost this bizarro world, funhouse mirror version of the lessons we learned from Sergei Eisenstein, right? Where if you edit something correctly, the audience will project the feeling onto an actor. We live in this era now where you often cut back to the actor. I mean, I can tell you exactly when we're going to cut back to an actor where they've had tears, you know, squeezed into their eyes, right? Tears squeezed into their eyes so that we can then know, oh, right, it's sad what we're seeing. And we need that now, as opposed to what Eisenstein showed, which is if you do your job right with visual storytelling, you know, he cut together in one of the experiments, right? An actor.
Yeah.
And the actor had the same expression. But everybody came away going, what a great actor. When what we were shown was sad, he looked so sad. And when what he looked at was happy, he looked so happy. But it was the exact same reaction shot, right? And so what that showed was that the human face is a projection screen and we project what we're feeling onto it. And it's almost like the Nicole Kidman, this whole thing, these masks are the funhouse mirror variation on it. But I think it's closer to what you're saying, which is, you know, authenticity and connection is terrifying for us right now.
Absolutely.
So we don't want to see it. We are made uncomfortable by other people's authentic pain and anguish and joy and expressions of emotion. You know, we're made
and or just aging, authentic aging.
Sure.
That's frightening, isn't it? You're facing your own demise.
I guess it is because everybody keeps telling us we need it to be. Right?
No, I don't know.
I'm all about I'm going to be a groovy grandpa right now, just starting right now. That's all I care about. Okay, so, you know, we're talking about how next week, before we started recording, we're talking about how next week during the show we're going to do a test to try to Skype in a guest onto the show.
Right.
A guest who will be talking about PodFest and maybe even giving a review of a screening of a documentary in which you and I appear, Dean Haglund.
Are we talking about earbuds?
Earbuds, yeah.
If
what I remember is true, we were interviewed for that documentary.
What you remember is true. Yes, there were cameras all over.
And it's screening at PodFest. We will not be participating, but a guest that we'll be calling will have just come back from there and might have a review of that documentary. But this gentleman, who shall remain nameless unless, of course, you want to call him Mark Hirschhorn. He turned me on to a show that I'm halfway through binge watching, which is called Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
Yes. Are you watching this?
We started watching
it too. We had the book on our bedside. Patty and I have had that book there, and it's been slow reading. There was slow parts, and then it got interesting and sort of exactly like the show. And so how far in are you?
I think I'm about midway through the fourth out of seven episodes. So I'm just about halfway through. Now that you've been watching it, I mean, compare it. Are you enjoying the show more? I mean, I think it really, I'm very impressed by it, but I brought it up because, I'm most impressed by, the brilliant casting of the entire ensemble around the two leads. And,
yeah.
You know, we are supposed to be having, and maybe we'll begin, we certainly won't get to all of it, but we'll begin our discussion of supporting players. Because one of the leads, Mr. Norrell, is the great supporting character actor, Eddie Marzin, who I found, I don't know how to put it, but I thought one of the problems with the first episode was Mr. Norrell's too much a main character. And indeed, Eddie Marzin, that actor who's so good as a supporting player... you know, he did his usual fine character work, but it wasn't the kind of character that can carry a storyline.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And this was sort of equivalent to the book, where these secondary characters would seem to be in the middle of the narrative flow. So I think the show is keeping very close to the book, which may be a detriment. It was not to everyone's taste, of course. And so, hats off to the creators for maintaining a dedication to the books.
Clearly they love the books.
They love the books. And, if you like, tangents like that, then yeah, by all means, embrace it. And this is a case in point where you have a character actor who seems to be on the lead, but I don't think that's going to continue after
even though he's a while. Even though he's a title character, but some of
even
these,
as a title character, yeah.
some of these supporting players, I mean, just so well cast, and it's not your typical thing that I would expect, where it's okay, what famous British character actor is going to come on and wave at me this week? I mean, these are really, really, I had to dig. These people all have real credits, but they weren't immediately popping to mind as, hey, it's the dude from that thing, or hey, it's the guy. You know, they were coming on as the characters they're playing. And
yeah.
Then I went and researched them, and then lo and behold, of course, I'd seen these people in other things. And that's
right.
Fine, fine character work.
Yeah, they were disappearing in the roles.
Should we talk with the scant minutes that are left about character actors, or do you want to get to your first review of the recent women-directed films that everyone should see?
Let's talk character actors. Somebody had a busy, busy week.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, I filled in for you last week when it was your turn. So let's make that happen next week,
okay.
Especially because apparently we moved, we continue to wield a significant influence at the British Film Institute long after our documentary on comedy, Consciousness and Conspiracy had its world premiere there at the National Film Theater back in 2011, because... I don't know. Is it a coincidence that the British Film Institute last week announces through their Sight and Sound magazine that they are going to make a concerted effort to start incorporating films directed by women into their view of the history of cinema?
Well, another feather in our cap.
If you'll excuse me, I need to go get an ice pack because I just sprained something, patting myself on the back. But the point is, good for them for coming up with a list. They were coming up with a list of their own, I think, of
right.
this culturally important films. And there should be no end to groups that are championing films by women, historic films, international films, recent films, because I think, honestly, for the future of the art form itself, we desperately need to be encouraging and inviting and welcoming diversity, because it is diversity. It is new voices. It is women, hell, just at the box office, who are going to save movies. So let's start appreciating, at long last, way overdue, all the great films that women have already been making.
Absolutely, for all the years.
That I'm exhausted. So when we talk about, you know, this was a letter going back several weeks that Agent Summer sent us about championing some of the character and supporting actors that we love. You know, when you talk about character and supporting actors, and, you know, boy, I was thinking to myself, can you believe how long now it's been, we've been without Philip Seymour Hoffman, and still how sad it is that we don't have him. You know, Philip Seymour Hoffman would have been a supporting character actor equal to the best supporting character actor from any generation, any era.
Absolutely.
But he lived in an era where if you wanted to continue to be an acclaimed character actor, you had to prove your ability to carry a picture as a lead performer.
Yeah.
And because if you did not, the economics of the business now have changed. And if you can't become a lead player and a name as a lead actor, they're not going to spend money on you as a supporting player anymore. They're going to find the next great one, because there's only so much money to go around, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You have your lead actor, who's a big star, and then you usually have one other big star who's a male actor who's in a smaller supporting role. But I guarantee you that one who's in that smaller supporting role either is sometimes or certainly used to be a successful leading man. And that's not how, for the first century of this business, things worked.
Exactly. Think of, I'm the one that jumps to mind as you say that is Carl Malden. I can't think of one movie where he was a lead, and yet he was so great in amongst so many Marlon Brando. You know, that he could keep up with Marlon Brando and On the Waterfront.
George C. Scott in Patton.
In Patton, he was the lead.
But Carl Malden playing Omar Bradley.
Oh, yeah. But Carl Malden was the other general. Yeah, you think about that, and I'm racking my brain. Like, even Streets of San Francisco, the TV series, it really was Michael Douglas's name up and center on that sort of thing.
The young lead.
The young lead.
It's changed. So the economics have changed, and it's sad because you know, they're not the same. They're functionally not the same. You know, when we say someone is a supporting player, as I always say, what does it mean they're supporting? Well, for me, they're supporting the believability of the world we're watching. We will watch.
Right.
We will watch a film, and we'll follow a television show if the character, the lead characters are appealing, if the lead performers are attractive, and I don't mean just physically, but I mean, you know, in terms of their humor, their humanity, or whatever, we'll follow lead characters and lead performers that we like, or that we love, or that we're enjoying. But we will only believe the world that they are going through if we believe the people who are inhabiting that world. So that's literally what supporting actors are supporting. They're supporting our suspension of disbelief. They're supporting the very construct of the world that's being shown. And these actors who bring real life to it, who are basically, they're playing characters who are the leads in their own movies. It's just movies we are not seeing.
The camera has not followed them throughout this narrative. And also, you know, from an actor's point of view, you want an actor who has the chops not to be intimidated when they're up against a really great lead actor. You know, again, Carl Malden had the chops from Broadway, from theater, from a huge resume, so that when he came into the frame, he didn't disappear. There wasn't, there's somebody else talking while we're waiting for the star to talk.
And would not do what all too often happens, I think, when otherwise really accomplished character actors go back to a supporting role after having been a lead. I'm talking about you, Paul Giamatti. They have the confidence not to give these scenes too much.
Yes,
you know,
of course, right?
I mean, I don't, I'm singling out Giamatti. There are others. There's no, I mean, John Voight did this for a long time. I you know, the list goes on and on, but character actors who should know better, but I get the feeling because they've been a lead and now maybe they're frustrated, maybe they've forgotten, maybe it is a different skill set, whatever it is, they give their scenes too much. The counter of what you were saying about actors who let themselves disappear, these are ones that are giving it too much. You need to always, as an actor, whether you're a lead or whether you're supporting, you need to be able to have the confidence not to give it too much.
Right.
Especially in this day and age where so much of what we see is procedural based.
So true.
And where it's exposition based. You know, if you give the words too much, then we're watching something phony. You know, if you're playing a cop or an accountant or a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher, you may have your own jargon, but you know what? This is the job you do day after day after day after day. These words that you're saying have no special meaning to you just because there's a camera rolling.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah, you're going to deliver this because it's just...
But it's the job that that character embodies. But who that character is the life outside that scene we're seeing. So how do you let that life in? And the actors that do that are the ones who are the character actors you want to see and that you want to hire. And these were the ones that in the golden age you would see turning up again and again and again. The Porter Halls, the Walter Brennans, the William Demarests. And so many women as well. But it's so maybe again next week we'll think about some of the contemporary ones we love. We're completely out of time. We've run over. Call the network.
Oh my gosh.
We're going to take too much time this week. That does bring us to an end of another exciting action-packed installment of everyone's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Hooray!
People can find every installment of Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. They can download them, stream them, and subscribe via iTunes.
Has anybody written a review?
I don't know in a while. I'll check out the iTunes. Always, we're brought to you by Empire State Gas. It's organically grown and farm-raised. And did you say delicious?
Yeah.
From farm to pump, we've got great gas, Empire State Gas. We're hosted by the good folks at Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, Blog Talk Radio. We can be heard all new episodes on Stitcher Radio and Fanboy Nation, purveyor of all things nerd culture.
Right.
And you can write us, as several people did this week, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
And follow us on Twitter. We're at Dean and Phil.
You know, I joined Instagram.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we'll talk about that on a slow show in the future. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Take care, Dean.
Bye.
Belated spoiler alert.